Welcome to the GWP podcast. I'm your host Nikhil Rabindra. You see, in the 90s, I think there was a fad where a lot of parents thought it was cool to name their child Nikhil. In our own school, there were at least 5 or 10 Nikhils in our batch at one point. My guest today is one such Nikhil. Let's get started with our conversation with Nikhil Ravichandar. Welcome to the GWB podcast. I'm your host, Nikhil Rabindra. So when we do these episodes, I'm always talking to friends from school. And this is yet another friend from school. But we have a lot in common. And by that, I mean literally. So back in the 90s, every parent decided it was cool to name their son Nikhil. So even our batch had around 10 Nikhils at some point. And even with me being Nikhil R, and there was another Nikhil R. So we had to sit with each other in class most of the time when we were in the same class. So today's guest is Nikhil Ravichandar. Hey, Nikhil. It's so weird to say Nikhil to each other. We always call
it's always weird. It's never gotten unweird,
yeah,
to be honest. But yeah. Especially, I think since you and I have spent so much time together, exactly as you were saying, in the same class, sitting next to each other in the same roll number as well.
Yeah.
I think that when I call you Nikhil, it's almost very personal.
It is. Yeah. And I think this is the most we will call each other Nikhil in our lifetime in this particular podcast, because otherwise
that's true.
Hey, you.
Yeah. Hey, you. What's up?
Yeah. But yeah, welcome to the podcast, Nikhil. And yeah, that sounds so weird still. But welcome. And let's talk about your GWB, first of all. Do you remember what was in your GWB?
Yeah. So it's such a great name for the podcast, by the way. I think my GWB was just a scribble pad for the most part, and a place that I used to take a lot of notes, much like I think some of your other guests have talked about in previous episodes. If you didn't bring the book that was needed and you needed to find a way to ensure that the teacher didn't know that you didn't bring your chemistry book or your maths book or your Hindi book, then the GWP was the universal book. You would say these next 15 pages are my open close quotes Hindi notebook. So yeah. If the Hindi teacher does come, and turn a couple of pages back, you know, the hope is that they'll see some Hindi still think that it's your Hindi book. And so my GWB always had my timetable in it. I used to draw it. I think that was a thing where it definitely was in the school diary, but I think I was one of those people who also had it in my GWB. I don't know why I needed the security, maybe just to know what was coming up, but yeah, I did have that as well. And outside of it, it was just a scribble book that page cricket, where we would essentially write down the numbers and then, of course, playing a lot of games with people across the years. I'm actually unsure if we had GWB books when we got to ISC. Probably not. It's up to us to decide. When did GWB stop being a concept? I think it's maybe about like 7th standard or something like that, right? Like, or did we continue till the 10th? I'm not sure.
I think GWB ended as a concept when people assumed that we'd be responsible enough to bring our notebook.
That's fair enough.
But and to your point, when we came to ISC, I think we wasted a lot of money in buying so many notebooks, because I don't think I stuck to writing notes after a point. Because even the teachers were like, we're not going to correct it. You didn't have to submit books anymore, right? So it was just like, you write it down, we trust you that if you made it this far, it'll be good. So
yeah. Also, we received pretty sure we received branded, like school branded notebooks in ISC. Like that's when they launched it, right? Like where it had like a Cotonian leaf. And so you could buy a bunch of those books, right? Like, so it seems like it was a good business model as well from the schools, like, and to try and incentivize that.
And you know what it was? It was actually a slightly different dimension from what you would get in a stationery shop. So if you try to cheap out on it, it would be like if you had to cheap out on it, you would easily when you stack your books together, yours would be the odd one out.
Yeah, you'd know immediately. Yeah, it'd just stick out. Yeah, that's actually so true. It's pretty like ingenious design, you know, by the notebook makers to ensure that, like, yeah, you have kids buying as many of those books. I'm pretty sure I still have some of those books in my old cupboard that probably have like 40, 50 pages unused in each book. It's a good chance.
Still useful then, right? So I mean, I also feel like Bishop Cotton's had for maybe a better publishing company than most publishing companies, now that I think about it, because these books they were making separately, the hymn books we made every year, then all the magazines. So the amount of publishing, and imagine every magazine was going to like 6,000 kids, right? So that's 6,000 copies at the very least per year being published.
School diaries, hymn books. You're right, actually. It was a good, I'm guessing it was a Church of South India publisher that the school most likely contracted. But it was a fully integrated business model. You definitely got the sense. I'm sure I'd be really curious to find out who made the school flashes, you know? And you have to make all of the different flashes for junior school, the rounded ones. Then it has to become a rectangular one later. I'm sure that and the flash business was pretty profitable because kids, you know, so many of those broke and then so many of them got replaced. You would forget them. It was what, $5 a flash, right?
5 rupees. I'm curious to know how much it costs these days.
Today, maybe 15 to 20 bucks. Maybe? I don't know.
That's fair. Yeah. That I hope it's only that much at this point.
I can't imagine if it's more. I think if it's more than that, then people are less likely to, because I think we were pretty, like, those flashes fell off pretty easily. Yeah. They broke quite a bit. Hopefully, like, the flash system has changed.
But you know what? Now that I think about it, I have a couple of threads to pull out already in this conversation. But the flash was probably the cheapest way to bunk a class. Because especially after lunch, you could come back half an hour later saying, I was in line in the school store buying something. And the teacher would be like, what? And you'd be like, it's a flash.
It's a flash. 5 rupee flash. Yeah, it's so true. And you know, there's also another thing about flash is that nobody else in any other school called the house badge a flash. Like, it's not a thing. There have been many conversations where I've been like, oh yeah, you know, I used to get fined because I didn't have a flash. They'd be like, what? You didn't have a what? And then I have to explain the concept that it was a badge that represented house identity that was fairly arbitrary. There was no reason you needed to wear that every day, like for every class. That was part of the uniform. I just like sometimes explaining what is a flash. And then they would say, like, why do you call it a flash? I have no idea. Do you know why we call that a flash?
I still don't. I think that's something I need to learn on my side. But no, but I think, yeah, maybe for like just the audience who's not from our school, a flash is a badge which you would wear. And it's not like every other school where you would wear a badge on your chest pocket or somewhere which is a normal way of doing things. We had to wear it on our left collar, I believe.
Yeah, left collar.
Yeah, on the left collar, not even the right. If you put it, and then you have to put it on your left collar. So like in case you bend your neck, I mean, you bend your head a little bit, you'll get poked by it, right? And it had to be on the left. And then the colors, and we were one of the only schools which had two colors to represent the house rather than a single color.
That's so true. And it's so, it didn't make that much sense also because we had 6,000 people. If we wanted to have more houses, we could have. You know, there was no reason why we needed to have only 5 houses, but somehow represent them with 10 colors. You know, it's like we could have had more houses.
That I know that, like, apart from Thomas House, which we were in, a lot of the other houses used to be from the old British days. They were merged houses, so I think there's to be like teams or whatever.
Oh, that's what happened. Oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And then, so then Thomas House, they just stuck with the convention.
Thomas House, they were like, I don't know if they like Bangladesh or if they like Christmas, but they said green and
Christmas. Christmas colors. and then it was also like they introduced it the year before we joined, right? All of us just got put wholesale into Thomas House. Like, you had, like, I remember in our first standard, like 80% of every class was Thomas House. you know, it's a very conflicting message to send to young children who, you know, suddenly where you come to school one day and you realize that there's this house system. It's like, you know, think Gryffindor, Slytherin, Ravenclaw. But at the same time, it's like you have 80% of the kids all around you in this one house, and then the remaining 20% is split across the four houses.
No,
You
so
really start,
you know how the others are split up. They were not split. So here was a rule. Like, I know this now. If you had a brother or a father who went to Cotton's, right, you could inherit their house. If you did not, you were an automatic Thomas House at that time. So everybody who was not Thomas House had a family member before, which
So
gave
all the Muggles essentially were put into Thomas House, and everybody who had wizarding blood, you know, was put into one of these other houses, right? Like, and so Thomas House was the house of the Muggle, effectively.
That's basically it. And we spent 14 years, I guess 12 years coming fifth, because like for the first 5 6 years, nobody was old enough to participate in half the events, because it was all these first-handed kids. Everybody else had houses like in 10th,
No, but
12th.
they did something. I think that they did something even more cruel to our seniors, because everybody knew who joined Thomas House. Like, if there was a new entrant who was joining in the eighth standard,
They
they were always put into Thomas House. So we had all of these people also who were joining, like, you know, probably joining a new school. They moved by our cities. They've come to Cotton. There's 6,000 people there. A lot of really arbitrary rules to follow, and then you're put into a house that literally almost nobody else from your standard is in. You know, it's like if you think it through, it does make a lot of sense. It's like this probably is not the best way to introduce a new house. But what is it? I think recently I was talking to somebody who was the Thomas House captain a few years our junior, and they ended fourth. And
Progress.
I think that was progress. Anything other than fifth, right?
No, I missed that. Yeah, so I guess Thomas House meant you didn't have like you said, not pure blood, or if you were older, that you were a transfer, right? You were like stuck in here. So, which I think is harmless now when I look at it. I mean, it seemed harmless then, but now when we look at it, it definitely had these unnecessary connotations that we can derive from it, right? It's so it...
Yeah, like it creates like a sort of this in-group, out-group vibe, right?
yeah,
Like that creates like this. I mean, this was a system like Cotton's is. I mean, I wonder if this is your opinion as well, but it is a school, in my opinion, that was built on the philosophy of competition, right? Like where it, you know, like if there were like a few tenants like this on straight on, but then at the same time, Cotton's would very much emphasize competing. And coming first, coming second, coming third. And the house system and the competitiveness associated with it across events was like a year-long affair, right? There was always a competition, like every week or every 2 weeks. If there were no exams, there was some competition, some preparation. And I do really, you know, always felt that the school philosophy was very much like, you know, do or die, more or less. It's like a very aggressive, winner takes all kind of mentality. Did you feel that as well with Cotton?
lot of trying to not die while trying to do, if that makes any sense.
Fair enough.
So yeah, I mean, definitely. See, actually, that brings me to a very interesting point, which I thought I was going to ask you later. But in a world, see, not that I'm sure you make a big deal of it, but you were school captain in this environment, right? So did you? So, like, for me, I think I had my own pressures of do or die. And now that I think of it, because we were in Thomas House, because there was a higher volume of people, even getting selected for some inter-house things was getting difficult at sometimes.
Wait up.
So, like if you were like for me, like if I think I did Thomas House choir, I did Thomas House football team, Thomas House football team, and I played once for Thomas House volleyball. Half a game, because I was standing at the court, and then somebody in our batch swore and was booted out of the game, so I had to be brought in.
Okay, next.
Right. So that's kind of all it was. So on one hand, I see, like, for me, that was a bit of like just trying to get into something. But I think the perception of you being school captain, I always thought like you had it sorted out. So I didn't know like you also felt this do or die-ness to a certain extent.
Well, I think I think it's like a little bit of a fallacy to assume that, like, somebody's chosen a school captain that they automatically, just because now they've been elevated. I would say that the choice of a school captain is, let's say, 20% arbitrary, in the sense that I do believe, like, even in our batch, there were multiple candidates that could have become school captain. The fact that I became school captain, my own reflections have always been the case that I was kind of like the pick that was not vetoed at all amongst the teachers. So no teacher sort of stood up and vetoed my candidature. So kind of got through as sort of being an acceptable candidate that ticked a lot of the boxes that didn't have a clear red flag. This is how, like, I interpreted, like, this teacher consortia sitting down and, like, choosing a school captain. I think it's a bit different with schools where there are elections that the student body council hold, and your school captain is somebody that's elected by the students. That's a level of trust that Cotton's would never ever give its
That's right.
student base forever. And like, I think that so just by the nature of being school captain, I did not definitely feel like I had things sorted out. And I definitely felt the Thomas House pressure of I think for so many events to get picked, you had to do well. So I was, like, really big on elocution and debate, and to go for any of the inter-school events, which I really wanted to go for, you had to win the inter-house event. And if you were a Thomas House person, then what that meant is that you had to first get selected to participate in the inter-house event. And I think there used to be a whole combination of, familiar faces continuously going up for auditions to essentially vie for, like, these very few spots in these inter-house competitions. And yeah, I think that that really did leave a mark. I think my first ever real proper audition was in the sixth standard itself for elocution. And I don't even believe that I was the best person who did the audition, but the house captain at the time, believe it was Varun Shetty, or he might have been the house cultural secretary. But he kind of, like, took a gamble on me, and, like, that was the only thing that gave me confidence that made me want to even take part in more inter-house events. I often wonder, like, if you didn't gamble with me in that sixth standard event, for elocutions, I think, like, the multiverse of our possibilities seems to suggest that, like, my trajectory might have looked very different. And so there was a lot of, like, this luck and arbitrariness, and definitely there was, I think, this competitive spirit that I faced a lot of. And I guess the I maybe in the 11th standard there was a lot of competition for becoming school captain, but the point was fairly moot because the teachers would make the choice at the end. So you could really just, hope for the best. But when it came to competition from an inter-school perspective, I think I really took that in my 12th standard. So, like, as the school captain year, I took that very seriously. I kind of, like, think, okay, like, now how do we try and be the best in every competition we go to as a school? And what does that mean? And, like, how do we even support it? And there was some really cool stuff going on at the time, right? Like, things like the Asia Pacific, sort of, was it the NASA regional competitions for the Asia Pacific region, where we started to go. I think our batch was the first year that sort of went there, with Daniel Food really leading that effort. And to do really cool events like that was, where my focus was. And it did feel very do or die. It didn't feel like there was a lot of support necessarily from the teachers. It did feel like there was a lot of pressure from the students. Yeah, it was a very, I can, there's a lot we can talk about in the school captain stuff that we can unpack, but the competition stuff I sort of see as very different, because competition also existed in Cotton's very much in academics more so, and then in sports, right? Like, it was like a big deal. Who was the fastest guy in school? You kind of always knew, right? Like, who is your 100 meter winner? And then you always knew, like, who your standard topper was. and you kind of had a sense of like who the regular class toppers are.
Mm.
And it's all just, everything over there is like some function of competition.
You always had to win. That was the thing. Yeah.
Win, win. Or be average, right? Like, and it was really easy to be average. I think it was the, yeah, it was a problem in the overall Cotonian sort of, I guess over the many years, right, the overall educational structure of the school
yeah.
is that it was quite easy to get lost.
No, and you're right, because I think I mentioned this in a couple of other podcasts, but when it comes to cartons, right, because again, 40, 50 people in a class, unless you're in the top 10% or the bottom 10%, you are not having your teacher's attention. Like you said, it's easy to be average, and you're just that kid that does not need to be worried. The teacher doesn't have to be worried about. Even at the PTA meeting, it'd be like, oh, your math score is like a little low, just be better at it and be done. But if you're like in the top 10% or the bottom 10%, it could be, oh, your son is amazing, or it's like your son does drugs, right?
Or hanging out with people who are doing drugs. It's super extreme. You're absolutely right. But I think, you know, the experiment I would love to run is to have teachers score students without, like have class teachers, you know, score students without knowing the rank at which they were going to fall in class. I definitely think there were some years where, you know, I did well. And you know, exams too were a bit of luck in terms of your preparation. If you turn up and you do well, there were a few years where I think I was in the top 10 in my class, and I did have my teacher's attention. But it was kind of like random luck that attention had even fallen on me. But the mere fact that I was in the top 10, all good attributes were just being allocated to me. So there was a complete, you know, truth in the system. That your rank determined your goodness, so to speak, academically, right? Like in the class. So if you are a low rank, you have to be a bad boy. There's no way you can be a really good boy with a really low rank. That was like a narrative that, and similarly, it was really hard for them to find people who were like consistent class toppers to be the bad boys of the class. You had like this real dichotomy that. Yeah, and I believe we had ranks right from maybe third standard or something like that.
Maybe.
I think that
apart from kindergarten, we just might have had ranks.
We might have had ranks from first standard, right? Like that's possible.
Yeah.
They just gave us a class rank for our but I'm pretty sure I know that when I was school captain, they didn't do ranks up until for junior school. They only gave grades. So they had changed the system after we graduated junior school.
Oh,
but I'm just not sure, like what standard. But yeah, I remember. Yeah, so you would get a rank in first standard. I can't even imagine. So the entire structure was so competition focused.
I agree. So what I was going to ask, right, Nikhil, again, and I have again strands to pick on. One is, I remember. So you said you've been coming. I mean, you used to be in the top 10% or whatever for a while. But I think for both of us, strangely enough, I think our ninth standard was a turning point. I think that's the first time we went below. Maybe if you were top 10, I may have been top 15, if at all, but still had the attention, whatever it was. But I think ninth, and there are many reasons what happened, where it happened, but we both submerged into the abyss of the average middle section, right? So I think we both. I mean, I know for a fact because we got punished for the same thing many times.
Right next to each other.
Right next to each other.
And yeah, 9C, right? So that was definitely a turning point. And we were in, you know.
I'm not going to use any names, but the physics teacher of 9C did not like us.
Was definitely not a fan, and we were continuously like being pulled up. You know, one of the things. A lot of people, when we were in the 11th standard, were pretty convinced that I could not become school captain in the 12th because I had not been prefect in the 10th. In large part because of this teacher, this physics teacher. But also a large part because I do think in the ninth standard, which is quite normal for a 14-year-old, you know, in terms of like developmentally appropriate for people to explore a little bit more and to kind of, if you've been like a really good boy or you've been trying to be a really good, you know, by the books boy, for you to want to explore and, you know, like go and see, like, are things better, you know, like picking fights on a football pitch, like, yeah, is that a better life? Am I missing out on something?
Or using a topo sheet case as a weapon as well.
Yeah, topo sheet case as weapons. I mean, like, this is, you know, you put topo sheets in the hands of 14-year-old boys that are like cooped up in classes all day. Like some amount of aggression spilling out seems very normal and natural to me. You know, it seems like a very natural consequence of how, you know, some stress is relieved. But yeah, so ninth was a big turning point, and I would even argue that the 10th was in a very big way as well, because for me, I remember there was a very clear day in class. I came into the classroom. We were 10C, so we were the ground stairs classroom in the centenary block, which effectively looked like a jail cell, right? Like, and they would even close the shutters. It looked like we were just like in jail. I went in and I sat next to Rashid. This is Rashid Navlaki from our batch. And I just told Rashid, like, hey, I sit here with you now. Okay. And Rashid and I had known each other since sixth standard elocution inter-house practice, right? Like, we had gone up with each other competing for literally all of these various inter-house events, right? Like, literally any literally event, Rashid was always going to come and audition, as was I. And so he's just somebody that I had like a very healthy competitive relationship and friendship with. And I had like a very clear, I remember the day quite vividly. And I'm very thankful for it. Rashid's still a very near and dear close friend in my life. And Siddhant Mandana as well, who was sitting right behind us. And so I do think that like there was a turning point a little bit in the 10th standard. So I don't regret anything in the ninth because it was all of this exploration that I feel like I needed to do for some growth. But again, the school structure doesn't believe it, right? Like, so going into the, I think in the eighth standard, Nikhil, if somebody had told us, like if you had asked or we've done like a question, like, hey, do you think you'll be a prefect when you're in the 10th? You might have had like strong conviction that that could have been true. But I think in the ninth standard, any chance of being prefect, I think you and I both knew that that was never going to happen. And then I truly did believe like that was going to be the coffin in the nail for me when I was in the 12th standard, because a lot of the narrative, again, that I would find teachers using on students being that like, oh, if this guy was a bad boy, and so he was, you know, he has this bad reputation in ninth standard, and therefore, you know, we should definitely not consider him for school captain, right? Like, he can become cultural secretary. I genuinely thought that that was like how the logic, or he could be like head of day scholars. And I did believe like that was how the morality worked in at least a teacher's mind of scoring students.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we didn't attribute, even the institution as well as students, right? I think we never attributed that people can change for better or for worse.
True.
So no, I get that. And like, I was always very curious because, of course, the statement you made about not being a prefect in 10th and becoming school captain in 12th was definitely something everybody said, thought, felt, right? I mean, that was just the wave. So I was also, I mean, I guess that, I mean, I don't want to linger too much on a lot of the bitchiness we used to do a bit beyond so I guess you I think you, in a way, even though you held that title, you still had these kind of eyes and ears around you, which was always trying to see what you were about. What I want to ask you from, and we'll finish the school captain topic after this because we have many more things, but what were, so we knew you had to like hoist the flag every Monday. let's start. How did, since you're the only school captain I know, do you get trained how to hoist the flag? How does that work?
I got like 15 to 20 minutes with the NCC guy and Anuldhat. I think Anuldhat was not at all happy, I think, with me being like, he didn't think I would make a good NCC candidate. So he didn't think, as obviously, like, you know, it was a little bit like an insult to him that he was going to be the one doing the flag every day or every Monday. And so it was like a very harsh lesson, you know, in terms of like doing it properly. And the first week of me like hoisting this flag, I would get feedback from him almost every day. So like it was like a real like stressful moment for me in terms of like having to hoist this flag. And I was always terrified that I was going to hoist this flag and it was going to fall while we were singing the hymns.
Okay, so that was my question. Like, my question was like, were you scared that did you tie it strong enough, or like it will like come out and fall down?
I was terrified. Yeah, absolutely, I could drop it. Like, if I didn't tie it well, right? Like, so I had to tie it really well every time. I think it's one of the real miracles that like it was never an issue or never a problem, and that thankfully, like, but it was like a quirk. So yeah, the school captain always hoists. And you know, there is like a real subtlety here. I was only allowed to hoist the school flag, right? So if it would be the lead NCC cadet who would hoist an Indian flag, if there ever was, right? And on sports teams and stuff, like Canada, Indian flag would go to the NCC cadet. Of course, always house flag would go to the house captains. And the school captain could be swapped out for a head of day scholars or head of boarders, no problem. So if I was not in the school, so it was not like a super exclusive thing, and like there was like a lot of subtleties to how to do it, but it was a real quirk of the school captain position. It's not one that I really enjoyed. Maybe other people like really felt proud raising it, but for me it was very anxiety motivated. I did not want the flag to fall in front of 6,000 students singing. You know that would be the talk of town for like the next month, right?
Yeah, because it drops silence at that time, right? We all have to keep quiet. So, like, I think the additional silence also gets to you at that point, because like usually if there's more sound around you, you're like, okay, I guess I'm just doing my thing. But now you're like, I have all these eyes on me right now.
There was a whole second thing as well, which is like during the invocation ceremony and everything, where I forget the teacher, but like one of the junior school teachers who was in charge of the ceremony, she quizzed me on the school song. Every verse, she made me say it a bunch of times. She wanted to confirm I knew how to sing all five or six verses. And, you know, I had never, except for like a GK exam or something, you never learn the school song outside of the first verse, right? But I had to like, I remember like being terrified of that as well. For every event, it was a function of like making sure that I knew the whole school song.
Yeah. Right. Pressures. No, I didn't know all these things, but like, let's talk about a little more about so you spoke a little bit about some of the victories or some of the things you look back feeling happy about being captain. Like you said, the Asia Pacific event was one thing. I think it was probably during when you were captain, we did a couple of other things, right? We did
synchronize.
I'm not going to synchronize now because I have something specific to ask you in the second half for all right, so we'll put a pin on synchronize for now, but I want to everything except synchronize, walk me through that. So there was a moot court, there was a couple of other things, right? So how much what are the things you can look back other than synchronize?
Okay, so you know what I'll do is I will give me like maybe let's say I'm looking at the clock, so give me 3 minutes and I'll walk you through how I thought about like the school captaincy, and you feel free to edit as required, Nikhil. But like, yeah, so I think like right at the beginning and right at the outset, when something has to be said is that like, you know, I was called into, you know, the principal's office and all of the heads of departments were there, and Ebenezer had just left. So understanding the political climate is that there were a lot of these teachers who had not yet had power under Ebenezer, who is now had been elevated to positions of power in the year that I was school captain, and all of them wanted to enforce it. And the principal, Colonel John Ellis, was very much about empowering his teachers, which, you know, sounds really good on paper, but then in practice, it meant that like having to deal with very difficult teachers and heads of departments and do consensus building all the time. So the first thing they wanted is they wanted better discipline. So this is what they asked me to do. They asked me to actually create a better fining system wherein, if a kid doesn't bring their flash, then essentially like making sure that that's recorded, we record, to create effectively the police state of the school. I will say that the one biggest thing that I've done as school captain that nobody knows is that I will say that this police state discipline system under me was the most inefficient system ever done, by any other school captain. I really did not take this part of the job seriously. I did not believe in it. And I didn't think that this was the right way to like enforce discipline as well, which is like to create an IT solution for, which is like effectively the CRM equivalent of delinquencies for students, where we can track a fine collection system. But then it didn't stop us from essentially continuously telling them that we are working on it. Right? And I will say that this was like one of the few subtle things that did through that year. And I will also say that the next year after my school captaincy, the person that they chose the next year, Dharamveer, was an NCC cadet. Right, they did pick somebody who is a very discipline-oriented. So it might have backfired a little bit for the next batch, but for our batch and for everybody during my year, the small realm of influence, I was like, okay, like we're actually not going to be very good about like using the prefix to just, find all of these defaulters. And then in terms of a lot of the wins, yeah, so I think that there was the Cotonian moot court. So one of these ideas was like, why do we only do elocution and debate and theater? Like, these are things that we've been doing for the last like 100 years. Are there other types of events that we can do that could be, pretty cool that are happening in global best schools across the world? So the US system actually has a very, well-developed system of moot courts. And if any of the kids in Cottons wanted to do law, moot courting and, doing moots is a big part of law school as well. So it made, and it seemed so much fun to do, so it was something that we wanted to do. So there was this Cotonian courtroom. I think we made a tactical mistake there where we should have had more 11th standards work on the event as opposed to having only 12th standards work on the event, because once all the 12th standards left, there was nobody else next year who had actually worked on the event, right? So the Cotonian moot court never really had future years. But then there was synchronized.
Moot court, I was very grateful that it made only a lot of 12th standards work, because that allowed me to be a team liaison for that. So I think this was, and I know this very specifically, it was on 6th and 7th August 2008, because the Beijing Olympics was going to start. It was supposed to start on the Saturday, which was 08-08-08.
It was a lot of good fun. I would say that like it was a lot of good fun. It was just sad, right? Because you like to like see the next year the same event happen again. Right, and I guess the first season.
Yeah, and I
said we also did.
I said I caught most of it, and one is I enjoyed being out of class. Two was, you also kind of saw a variety of people and how prepared they were. Like the school I was liaising, it was the guy thought it was more a few good men kind of a scene. So there was a lot of your honor. Can you handle that and that?
Yeah.
Right? But you would have someone like from the girls' school, I think, what was her name? Sharanya or whoever it was. But she was there in that. A lot more people were like organized with going based on the facts of the case and everything else. So it was nice to see the spectrum and nice to see people like just even participate. Like the fact that schools sent people in and everything, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was amazing. And so it really just shows you, and I'm sure it's true even today, right? Like if schools were to organize like these different events, you will get a lot of participation across the board. And it's just a function of like wanting to do it and finding the time to do it, right? And August actually is a good time to do it because it's the beginning of the year. So we're not worried too much about exams and stuff like that, which is why 10th standards and 12th standards could take a big part in the moot court. And then the next big thing that we did, of course, was synchronize. And synchronize was really a function in the child and of Thomas Abraham, so our good friend who was the IT captain, who is like in the most sad of computer science. We want to give him a title for the Bangalore equivalent of that. And he really was very clear on a vision of what he wanted for synchronize. And I think the way he galvanized the entire 11 standard, 12 standard, you know, to the cause, and created all of the events. He made the and the music that you created, Nikhil, was so good. It was such a vibe, and it really like elevated it. And we were able to use, I think, that auditorium to a kind of potential that we had not yet seen.
Exactly.
Done well for a full event, right? Like, we use the lights, we use the sound, you know, we use the stage. We brought 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th into the auditorium to watch gaming, you know, Xbox gaming and, you know, PC gaming in the auditorium. So we did some really cool stuff during Synchronize, very much a function of Tom. And like, just a really fun story about that one, which is that after we had the whole idea, we had created a budget. And, you know, Tom was like, look, I want 3.5 lakhs to do this project, like, to do this full, to do this well. And, you know, when, like, 12 standard kids in school, right? Like, where are we going to get 3.5 lakhs? Like, we started actually asking around, and there were a couple of companies who offered to sponsor Synchronize. They were like, actually, this sounds amazing. We're happy to do it. And so we took the entire project proposal, like this competition proposal, along with, you know, this thing saying like, hey, you know, principal, it is like, it's probably going to be 3.5 lakhs, but, you know, we can get sponsorship. And I have a very vivid memory of Colonel John Ellis being very angry at me, saying, you think we as a school don't have money to fund an event? You don't need to go to an external sponsor. You want 3.5 lakhs? 3.5 lakhs is yours, you know, like, go ahead, whatever you want, no questions asked. You don't need to seek any external funding for this competition. Just go forth and conquer. Yeah. And I remember, like, that, like, without that endorsement, I don't think that that event happens the way it did. But it was amazing. I don't even know the numbers, but I know it's still going on,
of course,
is like really a testament of that event.
No, it was really cool because, so one is, and I hope to get Tom on this podcast so that I do a deep dive of everything he did for that. But from what I remember,
that'll be so much fun.
So great. But like you said, one is I think he actually kind of broke, Nikhil, to be honest, broke what we spoke about early on about, you know, you being top 10, bottom 10, and I mean, good.
Very true.
So yeah. Tom literally said, you know, anyone who wants a say in it, come talk to me. If I find value in you, I will make it happen. Right. So
yeah, very true.
Even my point is, even the music which I did, I mean, like, this is me recording into a small laptop with barely any experience, but I basically composed this. So the cool thing I did was, the lyrics I wrote was, every verse had one event in it. So
you should put a snippet of this song in at some point in time in this podcast, Nikhil. Just so that, like, you know, the listeners at home can hear a little bit of the vibe. And then, of course, you can caveat it with saying, you know, it was like 15 years ago. And but it was so good.
No, I'll put it. That's a good idea. I will put it right after this. Now that I think about it, the way Tom ran it was very professional, but startup, flat hierarchy, professional. Because you know what happened? I remember this very vividly. So I made the song and I said, Tom, can I meet you? I want to show you what I have done. And this was like during some of the holidays we had or something. It wasn't in school. So he's like, hey, man, I'm going to be in Garuda Mall at 11:30 a.m. today. Can you come there? That's how VCs work with startups even today, right? I'm going to be in this coffee shop, whatever. So I go to Garuda Mall with my laptop, with earphones and everything. And I played for him. And like, the thing is, the minute I played the beat, he started bobbing. I'm like, okay, that's new. And then when he started hearing the lyrics, he's like, oh, wait, I know that word, brand value. I know quad damage. I know this. He's like, oh, wait, have you put every word in here? I'm like, yeah. It's like, yeah, man, we're using it. Do it.
Yeah, let's go. Yeah, and
Sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, exactly. It was like this. And we were all hands on deck, you know. I think one of the real inspired choices we did in Synchronize as a organizing team is where we sat down and said, Cotton's not going to participate in this event.
Yes.
Right? Like, we're not, we are going to have the A team organize the event for other schools.
Yeah.
And we are not going to say, like, hey, here's a C team of ours that we want to put up. Right? And, you know, it's just a function of just, we kind of took the vibe that us as a school are turning ourselves into hosts. We're organizing this event, and like that's kind of where we stand
Yeah.
in this competition overall. I think that really, I've seen it in other events where there's a real tension between who in the school should be in the organizing committee and whether anybody from the school should participate in the event.
Correct.
And the fact that we all just said, like, we're all just hosting, I think really created such an amazing vibe. I remember after all of the day's events were done, there were like 40 people in the computer lab playing Unreal Tournament in this massive LAN game, Capture the Flag.
Yeah.
It was just like the most fun I think I've ever had in like the debriefing stages. And it was really nice because it was not a function of like, oh, you came first or you came second. It was really a function of, hey, we all got together and organized a great event.
It was the first ever after party in my life, now that I think about it.
Yes, it was an after party. We definitely had, we had like all of the shirts, made us look like organizers. And I think that we also did a pretty good job in terms of like both how we, you know, took care of judges, but then also how we took care of all of the participants for each event.
Yeah.
And I really think the 9th standard kids, and you know, they really like stepped up to the mark here, and including a lot of 11th standard in Synchronize was really important, right? Because I mean, the next year it became a science event, right? Because they added science to the IT event.
Correct. Yeah.
That's like those are the kinds of things that make me feel really happy about the time when I was school captain. It's just like, oh, there's like a piece of something that we all got together and did, and it's still alive, you know. And you know, like 15 years later, it's had so many iterations. I always like see the latest Synchronized videos that turn up on my Instagram sometimes.
Yeah.
Of like, you know, the kids who have created the newest animations and stuff, and some of them are sick. They're so good, you know. And I'm like, yeah, it's really nice that there was a space or platform that we were able to make.
That's a legacy, right? I mean, a lot of things can come and go, but it's a legacy at this point. It's what, 2000, was it 2008 when Synchronize happened, I'm assuming?
Must have been either 2008, 2009. Yeah, probably 2008, yeah.
2008. So we're talking about 16 years at this point, if my math serves me right.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, like, I do think it was always the case, like, you know, every batch believed like they were the most influential one. But the truth is that every succeeding batch had to come and organize an event like this. It became a part of the calendar. And I think that that was like the really exciting part, right? Like, where there would have had to be growth every year from those students to be able to step up and organize an event like that. And also we allowed so many people from the school to come and watch so many events.
Correct, correct.
That was also, I think, a really good, like, because we filled up the auditorium, we filled up the hall for every event.
Yeah. And I think Synchronize, for me, I think everybody who was involved with it all believe it was their event. Everyone had ownership in it. Like,
yeah.
In charge of, Tom gave me ownership along with One Church for this event called Brand Value, which was like basically an ad campaign, but for tech stuff. But in my head, I was like, that was the whole fest. I'm managing.
Yeah, Tom told me, like, he gave me a task as well, right? Like, my task was to ensure that all the principal and all of the various heads of departments continuously give us permission for various stuff.
Hmm.
Right? Like, so it was like a pretty like horrible job in some ways, because it meant that, like,
you were a red tape destroyer. That's what your job was.
Well, to be totally honest, by the time Synchronize had come about, my capital with a lot of like key teachers, including our vice principal at the time, was very low,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, the vice principal got very angry with me on St. Peter's Day because I turned up like 4 minutes late for practice. And then, you know, she went to this huge, and I had to carry the cross on St. Peter's Day. And I'm not Christian, and she was a very devout Christian. And she felt like I was insulting her religion by turning up 4 minutes late for that practice. She never sort of forgot that. She would, you know, the scowl on her face, she would see me, was really like, difficult, but she would always smile whenever she saw Sinan Mandana, who was also the Pettigrew House captain. And she was actually the head of that house as well. So whenever we needed anything from her, any kind of permission, we would find Siddhant and send him. You know, so for me, it was more like red tape remover, but not personally. Like not always going myself, but like sending the right person to get the right permission to do something. But yeah, you're right. And every, like, but there were like, what, 9 events? And like each event had this kind of ownership, where every single event had like a whole group of, I was talking to Abraham Koshi recently. So he was like, what, it must have been in the 10th standard when we were in the 12th.
Yeah, 2 years younger
and
than.
He was in charge of like shepherding some of the judges, like greeting them at the main gate and then making sure that they turned up at the event. And his job was to steam with the judge, and he had like a whole list of judges. And he talked about that job, that role that he played. And you know how, and it was a very important role, obviously, because the judges are going to be the ones who talk to the principal, telling them whether it was a good event or not. But ultimately, like he still remembers it. Like 2 years ago, he brought it up, saying, "Oh, do you remember in Synchronize? I was in charge of the judges and like handling that for the first one." And it comes from Tom's style, though. It was very flat. And once he gave you ownership of something, it was on you. You know, he walked away, but then he would come back and shout at you.
Yeah.
Tom shouted at a lot of people during Synchronize. There was a lot of,
And he reserved his yelling for what really pissed him off. So he was not always angry. So it was more like, if he put in the effort to like scream at you, it means you really fucked up, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it was a quality issue thing. It was always a quality thing.
Good. So Nikhil, like I have one big question on Synchronize, which I will ask you after we take our first break. So let's take a break right now and get back after that, where I'm going to ask you one specific question. So let's take a break.